Montana's new U.S. Senator is sworn in. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us about a rise in high school students taking advanced placement classes. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry looks at the colorful history of the Conrad Mansion. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with author and skier Porter Fox about our fast disappearing snow. But before our top story tonight, we have this breaking news. As expected, Missoula County Attorney Fred Van Valkenburg went to U.S. District Court today to ask the federal judge to rule on whether the U.S. Justice Department has the legal authority to investigate his office. Van Valkenburg had earlier sent a letter to DOJ trying to resolve the authority disagreement. In a press release, Van Valkenburg says DOJ chose not to respond to his letter. The dispute stems from DOJ's investigation of how Missoula law enforcement, the University of Montana, and the county attorney's office have handled sexual assault cases. Missoula police and UM previously reached settlement agreements with DOJ, but Van Valkenburg refused, arguing the feds have no authority over his office. Van Valkenburg expects the legal challenge to take several months.
John Walsh has been sworn in as Montana's new senator. Vice President Joe Biden administered the oath in the Senate chamber today. Walsh replaces Max Baucus, the former Democratic senator tapped by President Barack Obama to serve as U.S. ambassador to China. The Senate confirmed Baucus's nomination last week. Democratic Governor Steve Bullock appointed Walsh, the state's lieutenant governor, to replace Baucus. Walsh had announced his candidacy for the seat after Baucus said last year that he would retire after six terms. Walsh is likely to face Republican Representative Steve Daines in the contest for the open seat. Walsh spent 33 years in the Montana National Guard, and he commanded more than 700 troops in Iraq in 2004 and 2005.
And in other news from around the state, Yellowstone National Park administrators say they may ship as many as 600 bison to slaughter this winter if harsh conditions inside the park spur a large migration of the animals into Montana. The Billings Gazette reports only 60 or 70 bison have crossed the park's northern boundary at last count this winter. A state-federal agreement signed in 2000 requires the bison population to be kept between 3,000 and 3,500 bison. Park spokesman Al Nash says as of last year's late summer count, there were about 4,600 bison, with two-thirds of those on the northern range. Park officials say the population needs to be reduced periodically to prevent too many bison from spilling into Montana, where there is limited tolerance for them because of disease concerns.
First and foremost, we've looked at hunting as a mechanism that would allow us to address population issues of the bison in and around Yellowstone. There has been some state-permitted and tribal hunting on lands outside the north and west boundaries of the park, and there's been some success. Around 100 bison so far this year have been taken by hunters.
Nash adds there are very few other options to bring the bison herd into accordance with the state federal government.
We know that absent significant removals from state and tribal hunting, the only other mechanism available to us right now would be to capture animals and consign them to tribal entities that we have agreements with, who then would take them to slaughter. You know, we're certainly poised to begin hazing should bison in significant numbers come outside the park. There are still hunters on the landscape, so it's a delicate challenge to ensure that we can provide for hunting opportunities and not interfere with those, as we might look at also capturing some animals on that landscape.
Meat from slaughtered bison would be distributed to American Indian tribes. Nash adds it's tough to predict when or if a mass bison migration could occur. Some years it happens in December, other years it doesn't happen at all. Nash says staff are prepared to begin the hazing operation should the need arise.
New statistics show the number of Montana high school students taking advanced placement classes fell slightly in 2013, but the overall trend is up considerably in the last decade. The number of students taking the college-level preparatory classes has risen nearly 40% since 2003. The number of those passing AP exams and earning college credit has jumped almost 30% in the same time period. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce introduces us to some high schoolers who recognize the advantages of these more rigorous courses.
Step into Helena High teacher Ryan Schulte's 1230 AP American History class.
Talk to me about what problems you guys think American farmers had during the Gilded Age.
And it's basically the lightning round from the start.
Give me one, Tizer.
farming techniques.
Is that a problem or is that an advancement?
Mr. Schulte moving quickly from discussion to discussion.
One of the best innovations as far as the entire West, miners, farmers, ranchers. What? Railroad, okay?
There's little time for students who haven't done their reading homework to catch up. That's okay. Schulte says the 10 kids in this period are engaged in the material, perhaps more motivated than his non-AP students.
And part of it is their surrounding. They get with other students who are excited about learning or want to learn or want to get better in the learning process.
That's part of it.
He's been teaching AP history for 6 years, and his enrollment numbers have stayed pretty consistent the whole time.
Usually stays anywhere between 40 and 50.
Statewide, AP enrollment dipped about 2% for seniors in the class of 2013 over the class of 2012, but that number is 40% higher than a decade ago in 2003.
There's been a greater opportunity for the courses that are being offered.
That's Montana Office of Public Instruction Chief of Staff Madeline Quinlan. The larger high schools in Montana often provide 6, 8, maybe 12 different AP course options. Bozeman High School has the most at 17 different classes. Helena High, where Ryan Schulte teaches, has 10 AP courses.
How many of you are taking more than one AP class this year? So, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
8 of 10 hands raise. And it's here you realize AP classes are not just for seniors. The two with their hands down, they're sophomores. They can't take more than one AP class. The other 8?
And all the rest of you guys are all juniors?
Yeah.
All of you?
Junior Holt Gibson says he knows some students who finished 11 AP exams by the time they graduated high school and entered college.
They actually started halfway through their sophomore year, the first year, because they took every AP class they could.
It can save a lot of money. Junior Margot LeClaire.
You only spend like, what, the $60 or whatever for the test, as opposed to the hundreds of dollars that you would spend in college.
The Office of Public Instruction says the number of AP exams passed in 2013 represents a potential cost savings to Montana students and families of almost $2 million. The office is currently searching for funding to train more teachers in the state to provide these classes. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
Kalispell's Conrad Mansion Museum is an East Side institution built by a city founder. School children take field trips there. Brides have their pictures taken in the summertime gardens, and visitors from around the world take the tour. This year marks 40 years since the city took possession of the mansion. Ketchum Fry reports at the time, nobody wanted the home.
It kind of looks like a hurricane went through there very rapidly and everything just kind of got dropped where it got dropped.
Conrad Mansion Museum Director Jennifer Sauter clicks through digitized photos from 1974, when the city of Kalispell first took on the Conrad Mansion.
The debris is such that it's stacked higher than the hearth of the fireplace. So you have chairs, you know, leaning up against the mantle. You have trash all over the, and not necessarily trash. It looks like trash in the photos. It's just, you know, many various items all kind of stacked and piled into one room.
Boxes of paperwork, newspapers, furniture, dishes, books, toys.
Over in the dining room area, you know, you'll see boxes of papers along with all of the umbrellas and furniture that you would find in a nursery stacked on a dining room table.
Vines covered the front of the building, boring into the brick and shingles. Several windows were boarded up.
And a lot of the local children around the age at that time would call it the ghost house, and they were afraid to come up to the door just because it was such an intimidating and scary-looking structure.
By December of 1974, the Conrad Mansion was owned by Joseph Conrad's aging daughter, Alicia Conrad Campbell. She was having a harder and harder time keeping up the house, had in fact moved into a trailer house on the property. Mansion media coordinator Mary Mears says Alicia never got rid of anything.
She really used the mansion for storage. When one room was filled up, they went to the next room.
Mansion tour guide Ginny Swan says Alicia was set on preserving the home.
She was the only one of the three children that actually spent almost her entire life in this house. The others went away to school. She stayed home with her parents, mostly her mother. But she always seemed to have this very strong feeling for the house itself.
Alicia offered the home to the city of Kalispell in 1973. It refused. She then offered it to the county, which also declined. Sauter says the city didn't get on board until a group of prominent businessmen got together to push for the city to acquire the mansion.
And so the Conrad Mansion Board of Directors stated basically that, you know, the city would take possession of the house, but would not in the future do anything to maintain it. So we don't get any city funding. We don't get, they don't pay the water bill. You know, the mansion proceeds have to pay the water bill, pay the electric. You know, everything as though we were a self-supporting business.
The city put some money in the property at the beginning, but this deal was to address the city's concerns about the property being a money pit. Sauter says that the museum pays for itself through ticket sales, the gift shop, donations, and fundraisers. The thing about the mansion is not just its local history, but also its regional and architectural distinction. Joseph Conrad was instrumental in getting the railroad to run through Kalispell. He ran Buffalo at the edge of town and ran a successful shipping business.
They basically established Kalispell. You know, Conrad moved up here, moved in here, established the Platt office, established the bank, the electricity out in Big Fork. You know, he just had such an impact on this city.
Conrad approached architect Kirtland Cutter, who was based out of Spokane, Washington, from the late 1880s to the early 1920s. The Conrad Mansion was built in 1895. Cutter was also the architect brought in to design Glacier National Park's Lake McDonald Lodge. Kalispell took possession of the Conrad Mansion in December of 1974. Then an army of volunteers took a couple of years getting it ready for tours. Workers had to sort through and catalog everything, resand the floors, and clean several layers deep into walls, carpets, windows, and furnishings. It first opened to tours in 1976. The mansion today is polished and clean, the original woodwork shines, and each room is decorated and furnished as it would have been as a bedroom, playroom, dining room, and mostly with items original to the house. Sauter says they'll be celebrating the 40th anniversary throughout the year.
I mean, we're just really excited that, you know, for any museum, any nonprofit to last this long is something extraordinary. And for it to be, you know, the dream of a little girl who grew up in this house and, you know, just wanted to really celebrate not only the building itself, but the impact that her family and her legacy has on this community.
The ribbon cutting when the mansion opened for tours was July 7th, 1976, and Alicia Conrad Campbell was there for the ceremony. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
It's safe to say that these days many Montanans are either watching the Winter Olympics or out skiing a local mountain themselves. We live in a snow culture, and it's one of the things we love about Montana, but that snow is disappearing, not just here, but around the world. That disappearance is chronicled in a recent editorial published in the New York Times and a new book titled Deep, The Story of Skiing and the Future of Snow, both written by Porter Fox, the features editor for Powder Magazine. Fox is a lifelong skier and now an advocate for climate change action. In this feature interview, Fox talks via Skype with news director Sally Mock about his love of skiing and his fears for the future, not just of the sport, but of the planet.
Well, I've been skiing for a long time. Since I was 2 years old, I could ski before I could walk, which I think a lot of lifetime skiers would say the same. I went to skied all through high school and went to college to ski, moved to Jackson Hole when I graduated and lived there for about 5 years, skiing and working at the Jackson Hole News, kind of learning the journalism business. And then after that, in 99, I was lucky enough to get hired by Powder Magazine, and they sent me all over the world to report on snow and skiing and mountain culture, which was pretty fun.
Not a bad gig.
A great gig. It was really, really exciting, and especially at a young age, to go to Istanbul or Lima, Peru, or even Japan with a pair of skis. It was sort of somewhere between bizarre and a real true adventure. So I was very lucky to get to do that.
And at some point you began to notice the snow is disappearing.
You know, I didn't notice it on my own as much as I read about it when two skiers from Jackson Hole called up in 2012 and said, hey, I think we want you to do a book on climate change and snow. And I was sort of taken I wasn't really sure what to think about that at first. I looked into it, and that's when I was really floored by not only how much snow is predicted to disappear from the planet in the next 75 years, but how much has already disappeared.
And you write in your recent editorial for the New York Times about a researcher who has been looking into all of this. And, of course, it is now the Winter Olympics, and we're all focused on that. But you point out that, quote, of the 19 cities that have hosted the Winter Olympics, as few as 10 might be cold enough by mid-century to host them again. And by 2100, that number shrinks to 6.
It was pretty shocking to read that as well. Daniel Scott works at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, and that facility has been studying the direct effect of climate change, specifically on the ski area business, since the early 1980s. They're one of the oldest research facilities focusing on that. And he authored another study that was pretty shocking, that half of the ski resorts in the U.S. Northeast will likely have to close in the next 30 years due to warmer temperatures and less snow. It all sounds kind of shocking. And then when you think about it, it's been proven beyond reasonable doubt that, A, the Earth is warming, and on a warming planet, it just takes 1 degree to turn a snowflake into rain. And as the Earth warms, there will very clearly be a lot less snow on it.
And you mentioned the statistic about the Pacific Northwest resorts, and also the studies also show that the Pacific Northwest could receive 40 to 70% less snow by 2050. And in your editorial, you say, if greenhouse gas emissions continue to rise, then snowfall, winter, and skiing will no longer exist as we know them by the end of the century. Quite a radical prediction.
I wouldn't say radical. I'm just a reporter and a skier, and I looked at all sides of these predictions. There are alarmists out there that predict far worse warming and consequences. There's a lot of conservative folks that predict less. We kind of went right down the middle of the road, and those numbers are standard. Those numbers you can find in any number of resources, places like NASA, NOAA, the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder, their equivalents in Europe, and those sponsored by the UN. Those numbers are really 40 to 70% less snow in the Pacific Northwest. The same goes for the Sierras. You can look at the Sierras right now. In January, they were, and even early February before this last storm, they were at about 12% of their average snowpack. And while you can't attribute one storm or one year or even a single decade to global warming, those types of conditions are what will become more normal as each decade progresses.
And you go on to point out what the economic hit would be, and it's in the billions, and of course thousands of jobs would be lost from this industry.
Absolutely. There's a lot of jobs at stake. In California alone, 15,000 jobs are at stake in the winter tourism business that could be lost if we lose our snow there. It's a real problem. There's the winter sports industry makes up a surprisingly large sector of the U.S. economy, almost 1 million jobs. It's pretty surprising for everybody to realize that this thing, the skiing that people think is sort of the leisure sport for the upper class, actually has a very significant impact on the economy. And as we point out in the book several times, this isn't just about skiing. This is about snow as a natural water storage system for water. And what it means in the off season, in the spring, in the summer, is less snow in the spring and less water coming out of the mountains and causing drought conditions, wildfires, mountain pine beetle infestation, lack of hydroelectric power, especially in the Pacific Northwest. These are real issues that affect everybody, not just skiers.
you quote President Obama, who said, quote, mountain communities worry about what smaller snowpacks will mean for tourism, and then families at the bottom of the mountains wonder what it will mean for their drinking water. And that's the point, isn't it?
That's exactly what the point is. And that, you know, his announcement, his climate action plan, just a few weeks before 108 ski resorts got together with several Forbes 500 companies and a big chunk of the business community and sent a climate declaration to the White House and said, we need to do something now. Our bottom lines are at stake. Our economies are at stake. And when Obama made that speech, he directly mentioned melting snow in the mountains and less water coming out of them for all the communities that live downstream. 1 billion people depend on snowmelt for their fresh water supply. So that's what us and our partners, Protect Our Winters, the advocacy group that Jeremy Jones started in 2007. They're the leading voice on saving snow in our mountains. And that's what they specifically are focusing on. A, the economic impact. B, the larger impacts of what happens when that snowpack is not there on April 1st.
But you do chastise the winter sports community for not being more outspoken about this. You'd like to see more activism and more education about it.
I do, and I think, to be honest, they, in a lot of ways, were doing the best that they could in the circumstances. It's very difficult to run a company, and much less an entire industry, that depends so much on the weather. You know, skier numbers have been relatively flat since the late 1970s. A lot of ski resort CEOs are trying to, you know, make ends meet, and many more have transitioned into more of a real estate company than a business selling tickets to put skiers up the hill. So when you're looking at that, looking at it, you know, from that perspective, to tell your investors and home buyers and whatnot that you're not going to have snow in 50 years. Might not be the most prudent thing for your business. And I, you know, their awareness campaigns are commendable, the recycling, the carpooling, absolutely. But what we need right now is national policy shift in how we create and conserve energy. And that is something that they're starting to get on board with. It would have been great to have them on board 20 years ago, but better late than never in this scenario.
It's interesting that as we speak here in Montana, it's snowing in the mountains, but we're about to get rain in the valleys because it's a little bit warmer than it should be for this time of year in February.
Absolutely, and that's what you're seeing. People kind of expect for the switch to be thrown and there won't be any more snow. That's not how climate change works. These are step changes over many decades. So you could be looking at a very snowy winter in the future. It doesn't mean that climate change isn't happening. It means that you're having a snowy winter. The planet is constantly warming because of how we've altered the chemistry of it. And those insulating gases are warming the planet year by year, decade by decade. That is no longer a scientific debate. That is a scientific fact. What they're trying to figure out now is how it affects the planet regionally. What happens in southwestern Montana? What happens in Northern California? That is a much more difficult thing to figure out. But what's not difficult are these historical observations. We spoke with Doug Chabot at Bozeman, Bridger Teton National Forest Avalanche Forecasting Center. And, you know, he's seeing rain events up to 9,000 feet in the middle of winter. And that's bizarre for that part of the world, for the number that he has witnessed and a lot of other folks, ski patrollers at Big Sky, at Bridger Bowl. We spoke with a rancher in Paradise Valley outside of Livingston. Everybody is seeing a smaller snowpack, and they're seeing less water come out of that snowpack every year.
Well, I have been speaking with Porter Fox. He's a features editor at Powder Magazine, and he has a new book out called Deep, the Story of Skiing and the Future of Snow. And that future is what we've been discussing. Porter, thank you so much for your time and for the information. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide, there's a winter weather advisory in effect overnight for the Kootenai Cabinet region and Flathead Mission Valleys. There's a winter storm warning in effect overnight, 5 p.m. Thursday for West Glacier Region, Lower Clark Fork Region, Bitterroot and Sapphire Mountains, and the Potomac Sealy Lake Region. There's a wind advisory in effect from 5 a.m. to 11 p.m. tomorrow from Missoula Bitterroot Valleys and the Butte Blackfoot Region. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with areas of snow and a chance of light freezing rain with lows in the 20s. Tomorrow, rain and snow are likely with a chance of light freezing rain and highs in the 40s. For central Montana, there's a winter weather advisory in effect from midnight tonight to 5 p.m. Thursday for elevations above 5,000 feet for the Rocky Mountain Front. There's a high wind warning in effect until 5 p.m. Thursday for the Rocky Mountain Front, Toole, and Liberty Counties. And there's a high wind warning in effect from 5 a.m. tomorrow to 5 p.m. Thursday for most of central Montana. There should be increasing clouds tonight with lows 10 to 25 degrees with winds up to 55 miles per hour. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and highs in the 40s with wind gusts up to 65 miles per hour. For southwest Montana tonight, there's a chance of snow with lows 20 to 25 degrees and wind gusts up to 40 miles per hour. And tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and rain and highs in the 40s with wind gusts up to 55 miles per hour. And now for the editorial comments of Al Smith.
Workers' compensation, pretty boring stuff until you need its benefits. So this is for all you workers out there, from desk jockeys and burger flippers to firefighters. And for you employers who want the best for your workers, what do you do if you're injured on the job and are unable to work for several weeks, months, or years? How will you keep a roof over your head, make your car payments, buy clothes for your kids, or put food on the table? If you're like most Montanans, you would have to rely upon the workers' compensation system. The work comp system was developed to meet two needs. First and foremost, it seems, the need of employers to protect themselves from lawsuits brought by injured workers. And second, the need of injured workers to obtain prompt, fair, and full medical treatment, rehabilitation, and compensation for workplace injuries. The system, while not perfect, worked reasonably well for decades. Workers generally received what they bargained for. In the 1980s, the system experienced problems. Chiefly medical and rehabilitation costs started rising rapidly, and the state bureaucratic system was increasingly inefficient. To cover increased costs, employer insurance rates rose. Every legislative session since then, we have seen efforts to lower employer rates, and the chief tool to do that has been to reduce benefits to injured workers. The Governor's Labor Management Advisory Council, LMAC, is composed of five employer and five worker representatives. In 2011, after several years of study, review, and negotiation, LMAC proposed several changes that employers and insurers wanted to reduce costs. The main benefit for workers in the package was a slight increase in the number of weeks they could receive permanent partial disability benefits and an increase in the cap on their weekly benefit as a percentage of the state's average weekly wage. In 2011, the legislature made significant changes to the system in the form of House Bill 334. That bill adopted all the LMAC negotiated concessions to reduce costs, plus more reductions in benefits, and it left out virtually all the negotiated benefits for workers. While HB 334 went into effect in 2011, we are just now beginning to see the impact of many of those changes. Cutting benefits to workers did lower employer insurance costs, but not as much as predicted, and it has adversely affected those injured on the job. One loss to injured workers was a change in permanent partial disability payments. Those payments go only to injured workers who suffer a whole person impairment rating greater than zero and have a wage loss, or to injured workers with a Class 2 or greater impairment rating and no wage loss. This was not in the consensus agreement that LMAC arrived at. An impairment is a significant deviation, loss, or loss of use of any body structure or body function in an individual. This has been a major concern for injured workers with Class 1 impairments and no wage loss. They now receive no compensation for the impairment. So those low-wage workers that have a finger or two sliced off receive no benefit for their lifelong impairment. Substantial numbers of injured workers have been negatively impacted by this change. The supporters of HB 334 estimated this change would reduce benefits by $22 million. Some trial lawyers representing injured workers will be challenging this change in court. But for now, workers with no wage loss and a Class 1 impairment get nothing. Initially, injured workers are allowed to choose their health care provider, and all providers are paid at the state rate set by law. House Bill 334 allows the insurer to approve the worker's choice as a treating physician, or the insurer can designate a different treating physician. This was not in the consensus agreement that LMAC arrived at. This has been a major concern with workers' choice of physician being overridden by the insurer, reducing access to medical care, designation of treating physicians in distant towns, and delays in receiving medical care for injured workers. Substantial numbers of workers have been negatively impacted by this change, which was projected to save $38 million. Again, some trial lawyers representing injured workers will be challenging this in court, but for now, insurers get to choose a workers' treating physician. The LMAC was reconstituted last year. Once again, it will be holding public meetings to review the work comp system. Injured workers and employers are encouraged to share with the LMAC their thoughts, comments, and experiences with Montana's workers' compensation system. One of LMAC's concerns is assessing the effects of HB 334. LMAC's website, mtlmac.com, has a schedule of upcoming meetings and other useful materials. The next meeting is March 13th. For the past two decades, the legislature has decreased benefits, and it has rarely responded to injured workers' concerns with ever-decreasing benefit levels. Yet all those cuts in benefits never seem to lower employers' insurance premiums enough. Hopefully, the legislature will take a close look at the balanced reforms that may be proposed by LMAC. You can be a part of the work LMAC does in the coming year by attending LMAC meetings or by communicating your thoughts and stories to the LMAC or by sending them to me by email at mtla@mt.net. This is Al Smith for the Montana Trial Lawyers.
Al Smith is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.